is the ethics, and it's November 1st, Monday, 2010, and the beginning of National Novel Writing Month. If you've ever wanted to write a novel, this is you look up nanoremo.com. N-O-R-I-M-O. N-A-N-O. Did I spell that right?
There's a W in there.
Oh, Rhino, right, because it's about writing. N-O. Rhino.com. Just a bit of extracurricular thing here. Actually, a lot of the most important messages about values and the way people learn values is largely through story. So American values are conveyed in the movies, in the novels people read, and certainly over time there have been novels which people have taken moral inspiration from and formed their values on the basis of. I suppose you could even look at the Bible is full of stories. Whether you believe the stories or not, many people take their values from those stories. And you look at the Bible itself. Apart from like a bunch of letters from Paul, you have primarily stories about people doing things, and then it's up to you to sort of abstract the value or the moral or the lesson, the moral of the story. It's up to you to try to figure out what the moral of the story is, and. Sometimes you get overtly pedagogical novels. Jennifer Government has a lot of things to say about the nature of government. It's kind of a left-wing polemic against a certain point of view. And then you get like Ayn Rand writing a kind of right-wing polemic. And you get people with their... Dean Koontz, if you ever read any Dean Koontz novels... And maybe it's not literature, but it's entertaining. And he usually works in some philosophical theme, whether it's talking about, postmodern philosophy is one of his favorite targets for attacking. He's even got a novel where he has a character thinly veiled as Peter Singer, who is for euthanizing handicapped people. And sort of taking it to an extreme. So you have a lot of philosophical content and a lot of ethical content in novels. So if you want to spread your values and your views to the masses, novels is a good way to do it. Or if you just want to vent your spleen, check out nanoremo.com, and you too can be a novelist. So earlier I was talking about Halloween and how there were two cases of Halloween candy doling out. And so my friend was carefully watching his candy and handing it out to make sure everyone gets a fair portion. And he left for less than 2 minutes to quickly use the facilities, and someone took the whole giant basket of candy and ran off with it. I, on the other hand, put mine up on my porch and put a note that said, take one, and it seemed that most people took one. A few people might have taken two. At one point, somebody might have grabbed a handful and ran. There was a few that were like on the ground. But it seemed to work out pretty well. And this does show that people tend to generalize in their experience. So if you have something like that happen to you, what do you conclude? You conclude people are basically dishonest. On the other hand, if you have a case where nothing happens, you might say, well, people are generally honest. And both of those would be illegitimate conclusions to draw just based on one incident. The problem is that we're emotional creatures, and for us, those things sort of tend to stick in our mind, particularly when we're on the short end of the stick, when somebody shafts us, we're thinking, oh, you can't trust people. Or sometimes if there's a particular person, you have a run-in with the police and a police officer acts dishonestly or hassles you, you think the police are corrupt, the police are bad, the police are just bother innocent citizens. And if you have a good experience with the police, or maybe you have family members who are policemen, you tend to think that all policemen are honest and hardworking and just have public safety at heart, not, you know, catching people with things and catching people doing things that are against the law so they can make an arrest. So yeah, I think what you want to do is try to find like data and sweeping scientific studies, or look at the broad experience, or ask yourself, well, is there something particular about my experiences which may not be typical? I have friends I'm not going to mention anyone in particular, but I have friends, and they'll say, I remember back in the 80s they couldn't imagine how Ronald Reagan got elected, and they're like, well, none of my friends voted for him. And it's like, well, you know, you're a grad student, all your friends are grad students, and they're all going into the humanities and social sciences, and they're a bunch of lips, you know, or people living in California don't understand that the people living in Alabama and Georgia don't think like them. And the same thing has to go with the people in, you know, Texas and Alabama. They don't understand that people in Eugene might not have the same views on things, too. So just something to think about, anyway, about how when you're thinking about what human nature is, or what most people think, or what most people believe, you need to realize that the world is probably much wider and more diverse than your narrow personal experiences. Okay, more about utilitarianism. So let's see.
Anybody have any questions from last time on higher and lower pleasures? We just talked about, there was a lot of discussion about higher and lower pleasures on the forums. I want to make sure people are clear on those. Several of the postings showed that there's some misconceptions about higher and lower pleasures. So I want to make sure people are clear on the distinction. So somebody tell me, what do you take to be the defining difference between a higher pleasure and a lower pleasure according to Mill? And then secondly, what was Mill's reason for drawing the distinction? What charge is he arguing against? And it's a hand way up in the back first. So higher and lower pleasures, what's the difference?
Higher pleasure is something that's kind of intellectual and has an outside effect. And then the lower pleasures are physical and kind of base.
Okay, good. So let me just repeat that because you're way in the back. So a higher pleasure is intellectual, lower pleasure is physical and base. And so that's the main part of the distinction: intellectual versus physical, mind versus body. That distinction. And then there's a parallel distinction, which maybe isn't as clear, but is also part of it. Anybody want to, what else is there to it? Well, Mill wants to identify sort of cultural pleasures, the cultural pleasures versus the sort of blue collar base pleasures. So there's a parallel in that cultural pleasures tend to be those which engage the mind. So think about going to an art museum, and you're going and you're looking at like some work of art. Renaissance painting or something, you're kind of noticing all the light and stuff like that, and you're like, wow, that, you know, it's really amazing. And it's, say, it's the capture of Samson, and you can see that the people are like wearing Renaissance costumes, which is kind of an interesting idea, and that, you know, people didn't have like greaves and Spanish, I think these are, I can't remember if this is a Spanish painting or not. But you know, you see this European armor from like the 16th century, which obviously didn't exist in, say, 1300 BC or whenever Samson is supposed to live. And you can kind of see the really interesting technique with the light. I think actually the one I'm thinking of is a painting by Rembrandt. So you see that. So it is like a really great painting, and you can kind of see the technique, and you, if you understand who Samson is and know a little bit about the history, you know the story of Samson, it kind of enriches your experience. Now compare that with kind of watching somebody give me an example of something which is uncontroversially lowbrow, which you might see on television today.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Jerry Springer.
Playing a video game.
Yeah, maybe playing a video game. SpongeBob isn't quite the Simpsons, but he's kind of sophisticated for a silly little cartoon sometimes. And there's usually some kind of moral lesson involved with SpongeBob too. I don't know. But I'd say, like, playing a video game, how about, okay, let's take a fictitious thing. I mentioned this in the forum. In this movie, Idiocracy, it looks forward to the future, I think 2050, where basically all the people on welfare and the people who have low mental capacity breed, whereas the elites don't have any children. And that's actually, you know, demographically, it's true that people of higher education, people of wealth tend to have fewer children. People who are in lower economic groups tend to have more children. And so the idea of this movie is if you follow this, you know, say, into the indefinite future, what happens when all the smart people stop breathing? And essentially you have a nation of low-grade morons. And what's the favorite show on TV? Anybody remember what it's called? Like the most popular show in the nation? It's called Ow My Balls. And it features scenes of men being hit in the crotch over and over again. And the people in this nation of idiots watch Ow My Balls, and they see guys getting hit in the crotch in various ways and bust out laughing and guffaws. And it kind of reminds me of my ex-wife. She used to have all these, what my parents referred to as her welfare friends. And there was this guy, and God bless him. He was a nice guy, but he was kind of incompetent and kind of lazy and kind of thick in the head. And he would watch like reruns of Gilligan's Island. And when, if you've ever seen Gilligan's Island, it's a very lowbrow comedy. And when Gilligan would roll off his bunk and land on Skipper and they'd both fall on the ground, he'd be watching and he'd go, hoo, 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 hoo. And he's the funniest thing in the world. And if he were to watch if he were to watch something like The Simpsons, and there was a scene with the Ayn Rand daycare center where all the kids are like left to cry and not held or anything, just left to cry it out and ignored. he wouldn't get that joke, and so he had limited capacity to engage his mind. And whether it's he had some developmental thing with his brain or whether it was bad socialization, you know, I'm not really sure what it was. But I think there's a distinction between Gilligan's Island and satire like you see in The Simpsons or Family Guy, where there's cultural references, there's references to intellectual history, there's references to literary writers. There's references to current political events. Same thing with South Park. Now, South Park has a lot of really lowbrow humor, but it mixes in satire and political commentary and all sorts of things that kids can watch South Park and enjoy, like the silly jokes, but also there's commentary on current events that you don't get if you don't understand, you know, pay attention to the news or if you don't understand the cultural references. And so that's when Mill's talking about higher and lower pleasures, he says, really, there's something about these highbrow pleasures with satire versus pie-in-the-face comedy, or watching someone get hit in the crotch, or watching somebody slip on a banana peel. There's something with subtle, sophisticated satire which is more worthwhile. Now, Mill's not saying that my ex-wife's friend who would love Gilligan's Island and would like belly laugh or seal laugh at Skipper hitting Gilligan over the head with his hat that he Mill's not arguing that he would be happier, that this guy who's laughing at the lowbrow humor doesn't feel as much pleasure as someone who laughs at, say, when Lisa Simpson says, I'm watching House. House is just about to get it wrong twice before he gets it right. or words to that effect. And that's like, if you've ever seen House, it's a joke. Like, every plot's the same, the false diagnosis, bad diagnosis one, bad diagnosis two, and then, some sort of nadir where things all seems like it's lost, and then finally he gets the right diagnosis. And she put it better than I do. It's something like, be quiet, House is just about to get it wrong twice before he gets it right, or something like that. And it's a funny joke if you know House. I don't know if anyone else sees some sophisticated joke. I haven't watched much TV in a while. I've been busy. Sophisticated humor. I don't know if anyone has seen any sophisticated humor, satire, comedy. Yeah.
There was an episode of South Park where it was like about the economy and like how everyone in South Park reverted to spending like very little. Because everyone was in this consumer nation, and it's where Stan is trying to return his father's a machine that makes like martinis, like a martini maker, and he goes to where he bought it, and he's like, I want to return this, and the guy's like, oh no, sorry, you can't return that. You have to go to the company that bought them all, And it's about like the housing bust, and how everyone.
Right.
And it was if you didn't know about the housing bust, you wouldn't get it. But it's like he goes through this journey of like how it all happened, and of course there's some other humor mixed in there, but like the whole skit itself was about the housing bust.
Yeah, so you wouldn't get the reference unless you saw it, knew about a little bit about economics and the housing bust. Or there's a movie called Brazil, done by Terry Gilliam, one of the Monty Python players. And in it, Robert De Niro plays a renegade air conditioning repairman. And what he does is, like, in this nightmare scenario of the future, the government controls everything, forms have to be filled out in triplicate, and it's like a nightmare bureaucracy. And so the idea is that he's going out, he's kind of this anarchist character going around, and it's people are waiting and sweating in the summer heat, waiting for their air conditioner to get fixed. And he knows how to fix air conditioners. He just comes in and does it for free, and he's like breaking the rules. I thought that was hilarious. But if you don't understand, if you don't know anything about politics, then you wouldn't sort of get why that's funny. And if you were ever work for a governmental institution such as this one, it's going to be even more funny.
There's a Geico commercial that he says, "Is Abe Lincoln, is Abe Lincoln really honest?" And his wife says, "Is this dress made by backside of a pig?" He says, "Perhaps a bit." And my 6-year-old thinks that is the funniest thing. He goes around for hours. Does my butt look pig? He just thinks that's the funniest thing.
Yeah,
that would be the other side.
Sure. And then, like, the thing is that you might get, if you understand that Abraham Lincoln was known for his honesty, it sort of adds an extra layer to that. So your kid, 6-year-old, just gets this, this embarrassing idea of someone asking a question that they don't really want to answer to, and the person kind of like, fudging the truth a little bit. But this idea of honest Abe, and all the mythology about Abraham Lincoln, telling his father that he chopped down the cherry tree, right? I cannot tell a lie. Chopped down the cherry tree.
George,
or George Washington. Tim getting there. So, but he's known as Honest Abe, right?
Yes.
Whether he deserved that, reputation or not, check out Thomas DiLorenzo's book on Lincoln to see as counterpoint to this idea of Honest Abe. So George Washington's the guy that chopped down the cherry tree. You can see you have like these sort of layers. Whereas if you understand it's Honest Abe, then that's going to be more. You're going to get it more. It's going to be more funny and make sense to you. And so it's these, but these layers require intellectual knowledge and background. And that's why, you know, if you have sort of lowbrow humor, that's not, it doesn't require as much to get it. And Mill thinks that not that you get more pleasure or that it's funnier, but just that it's more worthwhile. Now, one of the criticisms of Mill is that he's trying to smuggle in other values into utilitarianism. So he wants to say that somehow pleasures are more valuable, but they're not more pleasurable. But what is there to pleasure, right? There's intensity, there's duration, there's whether the pleasure leads to other pleasure, those three factors that Bentham mentions, right? Intensity, duration, fecundity, which is the capacity to produce more pleasures. How can one pleasure be more valuable than another if it's not more intense, or if it doesn't last longer, or if it doesn't create, you know, sort of a cascading number of other pleasures? It's hard to see. So one objection besides the elitist objection is Mill trying to smuggle in other values into utilitarianism? Kind of sneaking in. So Mill says, higher pleasures are more valuable, but not more intense, longer lasting. Not more intense, longer lasting, or fecund. It won't produce more pleasures necessarily. Although maybe he might have argued that the higher pleasures are more fecund because the intellectual pursuits tend to produce, you know, other things of value, perhaps more than the kind of blue collar pleasures of the masses. Now, one of the discussions on the forum we had was whether this is sort of an elitist bourgeois thing. So because Mill is a member of the literati, because he was learning, his father would tutor him in Greek and Latin when he was 5 years old, and he was kind of a child prodigy. Again, whether it was mostly nature or whether it was just his father, you know, tutored him. And I have a feeling that if, you know, anybody in this room, if your father was like this fancy lawyer and he was like tutoring you privately every day and teaching you Greek and Latin when you're 5, maybe you'd end up to be a prodigy too. Mill's father actually might have driven him too far because he had a nervous breakdown in his early 20s and decided to forsake a career in law for philosophy. It's one of the reasons why he decided to go into philosophy. It's less pressure. Mill is, though, the sort of upper-class person. So the question is he just saying, well, of course, you know, everyone should like, you know, the refined music and gourmet food and literature and art museums and not, you know, throwing dice in some rundown bar in a bad part of town. So what do you think about this sort of charge that Mill's really, he's trying to universalize his own bourgeois values, the values of the upper class, which is all about refinement and art and literature. And just he maybe if Mill would have gone down to the alehouse down the corner and slammed down a couple of pints with some you know, real solid of the earth average Joes, maybe he'd realize that that's just as good, that's just as pleasurable. What do you think? Yeah.
I kind of see his point, because if it's intellectual pleasure, you think about it. It isn't necessarily longer lasting, but you constantly refer to it and you extrapolate it out. So it becomes a greater pleasure. That's the way I see it. You know, the simple things are okay, but it's that thing that you can think about a year later and crack up about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would argue that lowbrow works the same way. I mean, between me and my group of friends, you know, we'll watch some low style comedy and we'll start back and forth making references to it, and you know, it becomes an inside joke, and you know, we constantly do stuff like that. I mean, I don't think that high grade pleasures are necessarily the only ones that you extract or can extract more pleasure over time.
Yeah, so now, in Mill's defense, I think Mill wants opportunity for everyone to experience the higher pleasures. So I think it's wrong to think about Mill as sort of looking down his nose at people. What he wants is he supported education to bring higher pleasures to the masses. And so he thought that, and he's reasoning the following way. When you have a person who's acquainted with the intellectual pleasures, the higher pleasures, and the lower pleasures, he argues that such a person gravitates towards the higher pleasures. And this is, you know, true with the friends of mine who are like, you know, academics, and you'll find them sort of like eschewing sitcoms for reading a book, or if they listen to the radio, it will be, you know, NPR, and when they go out to eat, it will be something sort of, you know, a kind of a fancy pants restaurant, and they're not going out and getting drunk and you know, going to Vegas and gambling away their paycheck, and they smoke cigarettes less, and you sort of look at people of the, you know, educated class. They behave in certain ways, and so that's, you know. And what he would say is that what he wants to do is expose the pleasures of classical music, say, or, you know, cultured music, whatever that may be, and art museums, and once you sort of understand that, and you've been to an opera, you kind of get like what opera's all about, and you've heard like maybe some really good opera, like you hear Ride of the Valkyries or something, and you're like, wow, I just heard like bad opera, I heard, you know, or some bad classical music. But once you hear some of the great, you know, the great classics, then you start to, you get an appreciation. And it's an acquired taste, and finally you say, hey, this is kind of cool, I want to do some more of this. Whereas if all you've been exposed to is popular music, this stuff's going to seem foreign and weird to you, and you're going to miss out on it, in Mill's view. Comments, yeah?
Doesn't that open you up to have more displeasures? You have this broader knowledge of all these things that should be pleasures, and then you're reduced to this, you know, chef that spent, you know, years perfecting one dish, and then you go somewhere else and it tastes off a little bit, or it tastes like pig slop. Aren't you more likely to be more disappointed?
Well, it's a good point, sure. And this goes back to what Mill says, better Socrates dissatisfied than pig satisfied. So why do people do philosophy, even though it's frustrating, it's hard, and you never come up with any answers? Well, it's because there's something about it that's worthwhile, so that when people are exposed to philosophy, they're driven to try to understand, to try to know, even though it's not very satisfying because the answers are few and far between. And so, and his argument is that people wouldn't do something which wasn't as worthwhile if they didn't think it was more worthwhile. And if you had a choice between, you know, doing philosophy and doing something which is sort of like some bodily pleasure, like going out and getting drunk or looking to hook up at the local dive bar, and you stay home reading a philosophy book instead, there's got to be something about reading that philosophy book that makes it more worthwhile, a higher pleasure. Yeah.
I don't know, like, saying that it's worthwhile because people value it seems to pull away from a hedonistic kind of view of utilitarianism. I mean, like, I was looking at the criticisms here, and under utilitarianism is too permissive, one of the utilitarian responses is, you know, bite the bullet, and our intuitions are based on inherent sentiments from our pre-rational development or cultural conditioning. So, like, why would you even want to rationalize that people value these things? It would seem that they are just wrong and that they should try and get as much pleasure as they can.
Yeah, so it seems that if you're a hedonist, you say whatever maximizes pleasure is what you should do. Talking back is distracting me and maybe other students. If you have something you'd like to share with the class, raise your hand. You had your hand up. Did I call you? You had your hand up earlier. Okay, I did. All right. So there's this question about if you're a utilitarian, you're a hedonist. If you're a hedonist, the goal is total pleasure, as much pleasure as you can produce, not just for yourself, but for the whole world. And if the way you can do that is by putting out, another Rob Schneider movie, or, Pauly Shore or something, or Jackass 3D. I mean, if you have a choice between, the remains of the day 2, or what kind of maudlin, artsy, movies out there that, I don't know what. There's got to be some foreign film or some, like, depressing story about a widow and her hungry children, or God knows what. You know those depressing art house films? Is there anybody here see art house films? What, is there anything out there that... A guy who died with a falafel in his head?
Yeah.
That sounds weird. sounds like weird porn, I guess. But you probably know what I'm talking about, where you have these stories of human degradation and death, and they're all kind of gloomy, and it's all about people sort of crying and arguing and losing their soulmate. And I don't know, just think about the maudlin, depressing art house film, or you go watch crazy, stupid stunts from people like the sort of the 3D equivalent of America's Funniest Home Videos, right? Or you can go on the internet and watch cute animal videos or whatever. I mean, that's like lowbrow entertainment, right? Or you can go see, I just think about The Remains of the Day. You know, it's some sort of foreign film that's about it's kind of like a drama. And you look at dramas, if you're an aspiring screenwriter, if you say you have a historical drama and you're trying to pitch it as a freelancer, they're going to just show you the door. Because those things have no commercial value. Occasionally, somebody will want to do something after. Well, for example, you get, after Halle Berry did Catwoman, then she can do Monster's Ball or something like that. It's sort of a dramatic change. After Clint Eastwood did all his spaghetti westerns and his Dirty Harry movies, now he can do kind of dramatic pictures. But the dramas, and the art house films, hardly anybody goes to those things. If you're making documentaries, you're going to be living hand to mouth. You're not going to be making money. Now, occasionally you get some people with a political thing, what's his name? Roger Moore is a James Bond guy. Michael Moore, he's an anomaly, though. Now, documentaries are kind of making a comeback, but few people make money. I mean, if you have this compelling story about a one-armed Guatemalan farmer, who was poisoned with insecticide, working for a big agribusiness firm or something like that, and it's all about colonialism and the despoiling of indigenous cultures. Nobody's going to go see that. You go to a few film festivals, you'll be lucky if you get an art house theatrical release. You're not going to make any money. But if you make some money about, good versus evil, and you kind of, you put in, some blue people, and you have, it's, in 3D, and it's got lots of special effects, people are going to love that. So, the popular taste is usually, the lowest common denominator.
and things that make you think and things that sort of require intellect to grasp are you know, not as popular. I think Mill's not elitist. He's not saying that, oh, well, the people who go to art house films are somehow better than people who go to see, like, 3D movies about blue people or, you know, or Jackass 3D or what have you. It's just that he says, I want those people who are in there to seeing Jackass 3D to at least be exposed to some kind of art, some kind of arty movie. And that if they're exposed to that stuff, maybe especially when they're young, they're going to be going out to the art house films. They're going to have an appreciation for film, not just entertainment. Yeah.
One of the things I kept noticing is this, like, the term worthwhile. Mm-hmm. In terms of pleasure and, you know, the whole concept of things beneficial and utilitarianism, it seems like it's subjective. And I mean, if something's subjective, then there's no way to set down a universal value system. Because I mean, like, let's say you got on this one side somebody that likes to drink alcohol. And so going to a bar is their idea of a good time. Now let's say you got somebody else who they have a couple of drinks of wine and they get a headache and it makes them feel nauseous. That's not going to be a good time to them, so they're not going to place value in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the higher stuff, I mean, you could say, oh yes, if people are exposed to it, they'll want it, things like that. But I mean, even like the tortured artists and stuff of the, you know, late 1800s and early 1900s all had, like, drug addictions or mistresses and things like that. So I mean, even the intellectuals and the people that were pressing bounds in, you know, areas of thought and, you know, in just enlightenment, they still embraced the base pleasures as well.
Right.
So I mean, it's like, I think it probably comes down more to just individual preferences. It's like, you know, say turkey is delicious. Well, it depends. Do you like turkey? If you don't like it, then it's not delicious.
So you really think that if, like, you compare, like, I know Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries with Culture Club's Carmen Chameleons.
I've actually met some people that, like, they literally can zone out on, you know, like, you know, independent style music, and they can be completely moved by a ballad that is written in, you know, a punk rock theme.
But is aesthetic value purely subjective, though? That there's no difference between the greatest works of art and literature and, like, just like some utter crap that's put out by some pop artist, which is just I'm just trying to. I'll probably offend somebody, but I'm just like, that song "Karma Chameleon" is like one of my top all. Maybe that's subjective, but you just pick, like, some sort of pop tune, which isn't, you know, very good even by pop tune standards, and compare it with, like, great works of art, great works of music. It seems that there is sustained aesthetic value. I don't know, Evan.
On a similar, building on that point, I remember one of the criticisms of Hume's emotivism is it doesn't tell you what to do.
Uh-huh.
So maybe, you know, it doesn't really tell you what to do in utilitarianism.
Well, I guess Mill would say that when you're looking at pleasure, he's trying to defend against this idea that utilitarianism is a view fit only for swine. And that if you believe in utilitarianism, it's going to be, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, basically. That you're just going to be this sort of base person who's as they used to, there's a couple old-timey words for it, a sensualist, a sybarite, someone who goes out and just looks to get the most physical pleasure possible and doesn't have any regard for culture or intellect. And so, you know, Mill's writing to intellectuals, and that's one of their criticisms, is that, and this is what they said about Mill's precursor, Epicurus. They referred to his followers as pigs or swine, because they were only interested in pleasure. And Mill says they didn't understand Epicurus, and you don't understand me, and utilitarians prefer the higher pleasures. So this criticism, though, is that really he's talking about, like, knowledge-related pleasures and art-related pleasures. And that really he's smuggling in other values like knowledge and art or aesthetic value. If I can spell aesthetic, I think that's right. And that if Mill was going to be honest, he'd say, well, I think knowledge is an independent value, and it's a value in addition to pleasure. And pleasure, and so when you're looking for pleasure, that's pleasure is great, but you should also consider whether it's knowledge. So maybe Mill really looks more like a consequentialist who says you look at the consequences of your actions, and it seems that he holds knowledge as an independent value, as a value independent of pleasure, and that he holds artistic or cultural values in addition to pleasure. So that's a criticism. He's trying to be sneaky about it, though. So what is a higher pleasure? It's a pleasure mingled with these other values, which he denies are intrinsic values. That's what the criticism is. So did you have a comment?
Yeah, like he was wanting to expose everybody to the more sophisticated thing. I think that's really important because you can't compare the two until you experience both of them. So you have to be exposed to it. And the other point with that is that of the people that do experience the higher ones, how many of them go back to the way it was before? It's like going to a Baskin and Robbins and having vanilla because you love vanilla.
Right.
Well, try one of the other things and you may appreciate the vanilla all the more.
Yeah.
Or you might find something that you even like better. Very true. Other thoughts before we move on? Go ahead.
I think it actually kind of puts a strain by him trying to establish higher and lower pleasures. I mean, if you think about it, almost any time if you like refer to like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that you know, if you don't have all of the base requirements beforehand, it'll cause some internal tension. So it's like if you completely neglect the physical aspect of pleasure, you know, it'll make it to where you can't really enjoy, you know, the intellectual aspects of it. But at the same time, if you live completely debased with no intellectual stimulus whatsoever, you begin to feel oppressed, bogged down, like you start to feel like you're not really living. So I mean, it would seem that, in my opinion, I think it would be more, you know, beneficial to have an open understanding and embrace every aspect of pleasure rather than trying to say these are more important than that, but rather see each one in its own particular light, mm-hmm. and see its own value.
You make a good point. So maybe there's sort of a balance to be struck between the two. But then if you're doing that, then it's what's the tough thing to do is to, maybe Mill could argue the following way, that a person will attain maximal happiness if they have the proper mixture of higher and lower pleasures, whatever that may be, and maybe it might depend on the individual. And it may be that if you're, now what do you think about it? Let's suppose you have some sort of blue collar profession. You're a welder or you're a plumber. And does that mean, you know, you don't need to do anything particularly intellectual, although you're doing certainly something which would require comprehension. There's a custodian here who used to work in a plywood factory. And he was telling me all the different ways, all the different things that go into making a piece of plywood. I have no idea how plywood was made. And he was telling me how you got to be layered and like the different processes that have to happen, how everything has to be just right. And it was fascinating to me. And it's like, he's a custodian, but he told me like all, you know, about the manufacture of plywood because he was familiar with it. And he was really good at his job when he's working at that mill making the plywood, where I'd probably be completely useless. So I don't want to say that he didn't have any skill or knowledge, but it was sort of particular kind of crafty skills and not sort of what Mill, I think, would call the higher pleasures. But it doesn't mean that... But he has a hobby. He likes to collect antique watches. And he was like showing me one of his watches. He brings them every once in a while to show off. And he knows all the history behind them and was telling me about the different pieces and models. And he knows a lot about them.
So I would say that would be an example of a higher pleasure. And although he might not have as many what Mill calls higher pleasures as I do, he's still got some of them, and that might make his life more pleasurable than if he didn't have hobbies which required it to engage his mind or sort of higher faculties. All right. Let's talk about some other objections to utilitarianism. Mill says some pleasures are qualitatively better than others. They're not more pleasurable, but they somehow have a higher quality. And compare that with Bentham, where basically you're just dealing with an amount. So for Bentham, you can think about all pleasures as being like little M&Ms or something like that, right? So you like pour M&Ms into a jar, and actually this might be a good Halloween analogy, right? So you're going around getting candy, right? And so the object is to get as much candy in the pumpkin as you can. And for Bentham, it doesn't matter what kind of candy it is, because one candy is the same as the other. It's all, so you want to just fill it up with as much candy as possible. And whereas Mill says, well, it depends on what kind of candy. And you want to get more of, like, say, your chocolates, which are not necessarily better tasting, but they're better as candy than, say, like your hard candies or like things like apples and dried fruit, you know, whatever. The sort of the lower pleasures of candy. But his idea is that all pieces of candy are not created equal, and some pieces of candy have a higher quality than others. But the problem, though, is he's not saying that they're more delicious, but they're better for some other reason. But if you think about candy, candy is better or worse depending on how it tastes and how pleasurable it is. So it seems like it doesn't really work. So objections. Oh, and this is just what I was talking about. Mill is trying to smuggle in some other forms of value. That's kind of washed out. Somebody in the back turn off this front light here. I just wrote that up on the board. So Mill is trying to smuggle in other values in the guise of higher quality, pleasure and knowledge, artistic value. Or pleasure and knowledge is a higher pleasure. Artistic value and knowledge. Sorry, artistic value and pleasure. So that seems like he's kind of cheating in that way. I think that's almost identical to the way I'm up there. So I'll move on. And the other thing we were talking about, that Mill is universalizing the values of the bourgeois elite. Any other last comments on this? We kind of beat this, I think, dead horse into a second grave. Yeah?
I disagree with Mill. Because it seems like all the things that he...
Yell from back of the room, please.
All the things he seems to qualify as higher pleasures just seem to cost more money. And it just seems like all his pleasures... I know it seems kind of like he wants to expose the world to them, but no matter what, it seems like they're all just expensive things and that they're more difficult to acquire, whereas the lower pleasures anyone can acquire. And I think whether he says it or not, that's kind of a big part of what he's saying is that he has that money to have these higher pleasures. While he may want everyone to experience them, and I think they can be equal. Like a 12-year scotch can be great, but so can a nice cold beer before a hockey game. Like I think it's all just you can appreciate anything, I think, to a higher level.
Well, let me disagree with you a little bit here. So, I'll let Evan disagree with you first.
Okay. I don't know. Like, costing more money. I mean, like, the aesthetic value of art, paints don't cost that much. Canvas doesn't cost that much. And, I mean, you can even look in history at, like, the Harlem Renaissance. Here you have this kind of slum part of New York, and they have this artistic boom. And I would think that would be, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to join in with the bourgeois elites in their particular theater, but you would create your own networks of higher pleasures and create your own artistic circles.
Yeah, I think it's true that, like, you know, gourmet food tends to be kind of expensive. Although we have the Renaissance Room, it's open to students. You can eat fancy food there, which is made by our own culinary program. And some of it's actually, you know, pretty good stuff. You can also, and then for some of these other things, I think Mill would actually be pretty pleased with the proliferation of, you know, education in our society and higher learning. You get the Discovery Channel and the History Channel, you got PBS and NPR, you got podcasts, you get the internet, you get the Wikipedia. And I have people, you know, who maybe they took a couple of classes in college, but no college education, and who know more about economics than Paul Krugman, for example, because they've read all these books on Austrian economics, and the people who've got, like, they buy a multi-volume set of Lysander Spoon, the great anarchist philosopher, and they've read it all, and that you know, put them back some money, but then, you know, for some people that would be like cigarette money for a month. So a lot of people will spend over $100 on cigarettes every month, and they might get some pleasure from that, but and also they're getting, you know, heart disease and lung cancer and some other bad things. You look at just how much college students spend on alcohol and partying, or how much poor people spend on illegal drugs. And you look at those amounts, and then you look at, you know, does it cost any more money to go to the Bijou than it does to go to the Cinemark to see an artsy movie. A lot of museums have a certain day where they're free. Usually there's like a small donation involved. And then you have all these, you know, art festivals and cultural events, which usually there's a small sliding scale fee, or sometimes they're free, where you can go and the, you know, sort of music festivals and art festivals. There's the poetry, you have poetry slams downtown at the Wow Hall. I've been to some of those. And so, I mean, there are, I think, opportunities for those things. So although, you know, the opera is still kind of pricey, right? Even the Eugene Opera can be pricey even with the nosebleed seats. But there are, you know, other opportunities to engage those things, and I think Mill would actually be pleased that today, I mean, you can buy, think about like Amazon.com, I mean, or even used bookstores. You can go to a used bookstore and get, you know, a book for 50 cents or a dollar, or go down to Goodwill, and just thousands and thousands of books, millions on Amazon. And it's just one click, and it'll be in your house a couple of days. You can buy them used just for, you know, less than $10. You can get all manner of different books. And that's pretty amazing compared with the Mill's day. You really did have to be kind of an upper crust person to be able to afford books. Books weren't being mass produced in the same way they are today. You didn't have, you know, paperback books. And so that's a big difference today too. And we kind of take for granted the vast proliferation of knowledge that we have access to today.
Okay.
It was kind of
snobby, right?
I was
I was endeavoring to show that Mill was not snobby the last 15 minutes. Maybe I failed. That still seems snobby to you?
Well, no, there's just the whole thing. Sometimes I sit here because I know everybody doesn't agree with me and stuff, you know, and I just had to say it. I mean, some of his stuff is not, but yet when you think about it, kind of like, well, you know, how I'm pictures of this, you know, which, you know, I mean, in these days and times you would kind of call that snobby, you know.
Well, it's only snobby in the sense that Mill thinks, like, it's important to use your mind, and that the more you use your mind, the better. And so if you think it's snobby, you think that people should use their minds more, I suppose.
Well, no, but, you know, it's like going to here, you know, well, I mean, I, like I said, I know everybody here is like, you know, just forget I said that. But
okay, right.
Not that using the mind and stuff, but just some of the things that you've been talking about stuff, you know, it just seems like it's kind of snobbish kind of the way
yeah.
things.
I think what Mill would say is that, like, if from the time you're 5 years old, you're being exposed to classical music and art museums and those sorts of things, and they're readily available to you, that they would just seem normal. They wouldn't seem snobby to you at all. And so that's what he wants, is a more universal acceptance. And he wants high culture to come down to the masses, in other words. So it won't seem like high culture, it would just seem normal. And then, you know, a couple of other objections. This idea that it's just a matter of conditioning.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's an idea, like, whatever you're conditioned to see as normal will be what you find pleasurable. So that's, and someone mentioned that idea too. So if you're talking about what's pleasurable, maybe it doesn't, you know, it's all going to be subjective. It'll be subjective based on what you're exposed to. So it's not that, hey, you expose people to high culture when they're young and they'll kind of get it when they're older and they'll realize its intrinsic value. It's that people will find value in whatever they're exposed to when they're young, and there is no such thing as intrinsic value. There's just what people have been conditioned to find pleasure in. You know, people can be conditioned to find pleasure in smoking, to be, you know, tied up and flogged, right? I mean, people learn to drink, like, bitter drink that has the consistency of mud and makes you grimace. And any child takes a drink of the coffee because they're like, oh, it smells so good, let me have a taste. Yeah, that's the first time you taste coffee, you're like, that's horrible, right? But then after a while, you sort of like you learn to love it. Yeah.
Just kind of going back to what you were saying about how we all have the ability to gain, you know, all these knowledge, like cultural fairs and libraries and stuff like that. I lived in a really poor community, and they didn't have public libraries. They didn't even have cars to take the places. They most certainly didn't have cultural fairs in these areas. And they didn't even have computers to, like, look up stuff on the internet. Like, what are they supposed to do? I mean, what would Mill tell them to do? I mean, it's like, there are places where people have no, they didn't even have grocery stores that had healthy food. All they had were fast food places. So it's like, that's kind of what I see with Mill, you know, it's like, oh, these people are supposed to, you know, multiple knowledge. But it's like, if we don't offer them the ability to get out of that sort of community, I mean, I just don't understand. I mean, like, in Eugene, we are lucky enough to have this sort of thing available to us, but there are places all across the country that don't have those resources.
Yeah, so Mill would say that it's up to, again, individuals who believe in utilitarianism and the greatest good for the greatest number to spread culture and learning to the masses wherever they are, including the poor communities. And Mill put his money where his mouth was and was a big advocate of education, gave money away for education, and urged others to do the same and to break away from the sort of class system in English society to a more kind of egalitarian system. So Mill's not looking down his nose at poor people. He wants to reach them with the things that people of his class are able to appreciate in the same way. Mill urged that you know, the greatest good for the greatest number. He wants to maximize happiness for everyone, not just people in society.
to a point, I don't think I would be like, ooh, happy, whatever. So, I mean, some things people might think would make me less happy.
Well, let's go. So he's not saying that the higher pleasures will make you happier, though. He's saying that they're more worthwhile. they're better. They're higher pleasures, which I think is kind of it's a problem for Mill, because it's hard to find a notion of a better pleasure, which isn't a more pleasurable pleasure. Because right? That's what a pleasure is. If it's a better pleasure, it means it's more pleasurable. Maybe I should. Let me just.
I bet Stephen Colbert has a word for it.
What's that?
Oh, more pleasurable. This
more pleasurable. Just.
He's the one that did truthiness.
Truthiness, right? I thought this is the form, but I don't play this in here for those of you that see.
I don't drink. I don't do coke. I don't do all that kind of stuff. So I don't come in on that.
Uh-huh. Well, it might depend on what type it was.
See, I mean, like, where I'm from, it doesn't have to be able to do all kinds of stuff, so I wasn't exposed to it, which may be what we're talking about now. I shouldn't have been exposed to it, so. Because I don't think I was
kidding. Open the network, are you going?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
Exclaim, are you perchance familiar with the works of Rimsky-Korsakov? Well, knock that behind off. Now, here we got something very sweet. Brahms lullaby. You don't need any second all and feet above or any middle town. You just drop this on and the sand has got you. Close enough. Now, one of Beethoven's most famous songs was the Fifth Symphony. It was written about death. Death knocking at the door. Death, that grim, grim reaper, coming to the house and rapping at the door. Does death come to everybody's door sometime?
Yeah, death come knocking at Mad Bennett's door last winter.
Well, Beethoven thought a little bit about death and then decided that if death were really knocking at the door, he'd sound something like this. Tum-tum-tum, tum-tum-tum. Now, I'm going to put the needle on this record. And we're all going to hear death knocking at Beethoven's door.
Talking about the sort of higher and lower pleasures. Again, he's not this sort of snobby person that wants to say, well, you know, my class is better than your class. But it's that he wants to bring, this is a great movie, by the way, he wants to bring the higher pleasures to the masses through education. And this is actually a great movie, I think, about, and one of the themes about this is about poverty and about ignorance and about education. I think it's one of the best movies about education I know about. It's called Conrack. You might recognize a young John Voight there, playing Pat Conroy, who's the movie's based on his autobiography, which is about going to this isolated, it's like an island town, which is like one of these little islands off the coast, I can't remember what it is, Alabama. South Carolina, yeah, off the coast of South Carolina, is isolated and poor. And actually, there's a wonderful scene where he against the administration's directive, he takes the kids out trick-or-treating because they've never been trick-or-treating. But yeah, it's a great movie. But it is all about education, about spreading knowledge to the masses. And for Mill, this is part of having a happy life, is having a life of the mind. So let's, any comments or questions about that? Let's go back to this. So some other objections. Yeah.
Well, it was talked about conditioning in there. Couldn't he have been just conditioned to think like that? And he assumes that, he argues that it's human nature to gravitate towards learning, etc. I don't know, that seems like a bias on his part. I mean, I don't think that everyone would necessarily naturally gravitate towards knowledge.
Yeah, so the question is, are you better off? And this goes back to like the argument. talked about those developmentally disabled developmentally disabled adults that I worked with. They seemed happier than me, but they had less intellect. But then when I'm asked the question, would I want to have a lobotomy or some operation in my brain to make me the equivalent of these people I was working with, so I wouldn't have a care in the world, I would say no. And then the question will be, why? Why wouldn't I do that if that would make me happier, and if happiness was the end of life, the only goal in life? And it seems that you either have to go to some sort of version of higher pleasures in a kind of a hierarchy of pleasures, or that there are other values besides pleasure. Okay, another objection to utilitarianism is that, besides the one that it's fit only for swine, is that it's too permissive. And by too permissive, it means that it seems that under utilitarianism, you could produce the most happiness by, say, killing an innocent person. How would that happen? Well, suppose you have five people in need of organ transplants, and you have a Lane Community College student who has an acute case of appendicitis. Maybe you take out the appendix and you save the student, but these five other people will die. This person with appendicitis might be in really good health. Maybe they're an athlete. And so you've got a couple of good lungs there. You've got a healthy heart of, say, a 19 or 20-year-old. You've got a liver. You've got all kinds of good stuff there you can just harvest. So maybe you put a little air bubble in that IV. Maybe you give a little more of the anesthetic than that you should have, and the person dies in some sort of freak reaction to the anesthetic. So you'll make sure you don't get caught, but then once the student dies, you also make sure he's got that organ donor thing on his driver's license. So once the student dies, you use his organs to save the five other people. And it seems that utilitarianism would say that's not only permissible, but that's your moral obligation to kill this hapless college student in order to save the five others in the hospital. Now, a couple of reactions to that. So there's two responses the utilitarian has. One is this bite the bullet. And this bite the bullet response is just that your reaction that would be a horrible thing to do is just your cultural conditioning. And if you think it through, and you think through the clear principles of utilitarianism, you'll see that actually is what you should do. The second response, though, is to say that maybe you shouldn't do that because there might be some long-term bad consequences which would outweigh whatever good you might do in this particular situation. So what might some of those be? Like, why, what, yeah?
There could be, if perfectly healthy people with minor problems are turning up dead at the hospital, people are probably going to be a lot more hesitant to go and access hospitals.
Uh-huh.
They might not come out.
Sure. Blake?
You get caught. You're not a doctor anymore. You can't help anybody else.
All those years of training and schooling and all the financial resources that went to that, governmental, maybe some savings, all that productive activity goes down the drain because you're never going to practice medicine again. And you may be a highly skilled surgeon, right? You're doing organ transplants. That's a very valuable skill, and now you'll never do that again. And the hospital is, what's going to happen when people don't go to the hospital? Well, the next time someone's got like a pain in their side, right? They're going to think, I hope it's not appendicitis. Instead of thinking immediately, I'm going to go to the hospital, they think, I go to the hospital, but what if they steal my organs? Evan?
I don't know, with the maximizing happiness, let's say, you're killing this, 20-year-old in their prime to save five elderly people that are going to have other health problems.
Right, so that might be bad for that reason. But suppose they're like some very important people. Maybe one of the guys is an engineer who's like doing some groundbreaking research in biomedical technology. Maybe another guy is just on the brink of a cure for cancer. Maybe you have a beloved musician. who makes millions, pleases millions with his a wonderful musical composition. So it seems like you could cook up a scenario where you'd have people who would be more valuable to society. And let's suppose this college student, he's, you know, splunking out. He's not really a very good athlete. He's got all sorts of personal problems. Maybe he's like bipolar, you know, so he's depressed all the time. But he's maybe in good health. So you could take this person who's kind of miserable, maybe they're psychological problems, right? And a lot of really good, pristine organs there. And then you have these people who are very valuable to society. It seems that you could imagine a scenario where that would be the right thing to do under utilitarianism, unless you think about these long-term negative side effects. So, Blake?
I think utilitarians could argue that if you kill that kid, you are preventing utility that he could, he could be the most valuable person in society who ever lived. You're taking a huge gamble by saying, well, he probably won't be, because right now he's not. You know, it's all saved these people, you know. Like, mathematically, the risk just seems to outweigh the potential benefit.
Is it really a huge gamble, though? But you're also taking the gamble that the guy won't come up with a cure for cancer, and the engineer won't, you know, complete his groundbreaking piece of biomedical technology or artificial intelligence or whatever it is.
Well, then utilitarian would have to factor in, you know, what the moral damage of killing a person is, you know, with the act of, like, it's murder, you know, how balancing out murder with the net gain of what that kid could produce versus what these people, you know, are left to produce to save their lives. I mean, I think it's just like the utilitarian thing, and that's an engineering term, which, I, you know, says that it is, it's a scientific term, utility, like, you would have to factor in all those things.
But, and this will be the last thing, because murder doesn't, whether it's an act of murder doesn't matter, only the consequences matter and the end result. So if murder produces the greatest good for the greatest number, if murder maximizes happiness, you're obligated to commit that murder, according to utilitarianism. All right, we'll do more on utilitarianism on Thursday. Make sure to read the Peter Singer reading at the end of the text, because we'll be talking about that. Or at the end of the chapter on utilitarianism.
Yeah, when I was reading that part, you know, being obligated to commit murder and stuff, you know, what it kind of made me think of is maybe like a Soylent Green.
Soylent Green is people.
Yeah.